This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Hi, I'm here today talking to Dr. David Jess from Queen's University in Belfast. Hi.
Hello.
So you've been giving us a very interesting talk about solar physics. Always seems a bit interesting to me in the sense that, one, it's something I'm not familiar with, but also the sun is so close by. I feel like, you know, we know everything about it and this big ball of fire in the sky, and that's it. But listening to your talk, there's so much behind it. Like, you showed this image of the smooth surface of the sun, but it's not actually smooth. Can you describe, like, the different surfaces of the sun?
Sure. I mean, of course, one of the things is you look up at the sun through many, many different telescopes, and even with a protected naked eye, and you see that it looks like this smooth ball of plasma. The thing is, once you actually start zooming into that surface, you start to see a whole range of different dynamic phenomena that you would not have otherwise seen. Some of these phenomena, I suppose the best analogy really is if you think of it as a bubbling cauldron of plasma. When you zoom in close to the surface of the sun, you can see what we call convection. So that's the hot plasma rising up from the inside of the sun. It begins to expand, cool, and then drops back down into the sun under its own immense gravity. And this bubbling convective process is what we call granulation. And it basically just looks like a bubbling pot of water.
And is that what brings the heat up to the sun and what gives the sun the heat it emits?
Of course, yeah. I mean, the surface of the sun radiates with a temperature around 6,000 degrees. And the core of the sun, of course, burns with a nuclear fusion reaction, temperatures far exceeding that. But a lot of the energy is brought up through convective processes to the surface of the sun, where we see it and we are able to view it with our naked eye. And that is the surface of the sun, the photosphere, that we're typically familiar with.
Okay, but there's different levels, because from what I saw and talked to you, you have this surface, this photosphere, but there's things above, basically, that are further up than the surface.
Sure. I mean, the natural thing that we can see with our naked eye is just the bare surface of the sun. And that is where we get the most of our light coming from. As we move away from the surface of the sun, which is called the photosphere, we come up to a height maybe around 1,000 or 2,000 kilometers above that, and it's called the chromosphere. And this is, again, a very tenuous, a very dynamic part of the atmosphere. And the temperature begins to decrease, as you would expect, because it's very similar to what radiative processes that you would experience in a day to everyday life. I suppose, again, an analogy that can be used is if you think of the sun as a fire that you would use on a cold winter's day, the further you move away from that fire, the colder you're going to feel. However, at atmospheric layers above the chromosphere, we really begin to experience physics that we don't quite understand what's going on. The temperature doesn't continue to decrease. In fact, the temperature actually begins to increase. And it doesn't increase on the order of a few tens or even a few hundreds of degrees. It increases by several orders of magnitude, going from the order of 5,000 degrees well up to multi-million degree temperatures in the corona.
How is that possible?
Well, that's one of the mysteries of solar physics that has been studied for the last 50 years at least. I mean, we're very familiar with the likes of the solar corona, which we see during very beautiful solar eclipses. And this corona has actually heated to temperatures far in excess of 1 million degrees. And that's one of the crucial areas of research at the minute in solar physics, is how do we come up with a star that is emitting at its surface a temperature of around 6,000 degrees, and how can that rapidly ramp upwards to well over a million, a matter of a few thousand kilometers away?
Is it over a million over the entire surface of the corona, or just by points?
No, the corona in generally is heated to well over 1 million degrees. There are certain isolated parts of the corona which can be heated in excess of 1 million degrees. In fact, during some flare events, which are quite popular at the minute, and you see a lot of these in the media, where the sun has erupted and caused these massive eruptions that we can experience the effects of on Earth, the heating caused by these solar flares can push the temperatures exceeding 20 million degrees.
And is this temperature decreasing after the corona again, or is it just kind of a layer of sudden increase in temperature that then decreases again?
Yeah, so eventually what happens is the corona is essentially the last shell of the sun. And that is whenever we have these very extreme temperatures. And it's this corona which actually drives very important artifacts that we experience on a day-to-day basis here on Earth. Things such as the solar wind. Now, this solar wind is driven by the sun's corona. And these particles, accelerated particles, stream their way across interplanetary space. And whenever they interact with our own magnetic canopy or surrounding our Earth, we get the northern lights and the aurora that we associated with the sun's dynamic phenomena.
Oh. And you talked a lot in your presentation about magnetic field. So the sun is also has also magnetic fields, just like we have on Earth, right? How important is the magnetic field in the sun?
The sun demonstrates a lot of different magnetic phenomenon. You have these large-scale sunspots that often you can see in pictures of the sun's surface, which display themselves as these massive dark regions which extend around the surface of the sun. However, that's not the only extent of magnetic fields on the surface of the sun. We have these other small-scale structures that can be less than a couple of hundred kilometers in diameter. And these are what we call magnetic bright points. They're these immensely bright little structures on the surface of the sun, but they still have intrinsically large magnetic field strengths, often exceeding 1,000 Gauss, similar to coming up to the sort of standards you would get in a modern MRI machine. And because they're so small in size, they find themselves that they can be very easily manipulated and pushed around by the convective turbulent motions on the sun's surface. And it's these motions of these small-scale magnetic elements which really may have very important consequences for the heating of this outer solar atmosphere.
Okay, so it would be the changes in these little spots that are on the surface of the sun that would bring the heat to the corona, which is much further away.
Well, you can imagine that these little magnetic bright points, because their field, magnetic field strengths are so strong, they will have a magnetic field line that extends far away from the sun's surface. I think one of the best analogies you can imagine is if you take it back to a very simplistic school experiment where you have a bar magnet and you sprinkle some iron filings on top of that, and you can clearly see the pattern that the iron filings take around the magnetic field lines. And the same sort of thing happens in the sun. We have ionized plasma in the surface of the sun. And this ionized plasma likes to adhere to the magnetic field lines propagating and manipulating and emerging through its surface. So you can imagine these strong magnetic field lines will extend from the surface up through the chromosphere and way out into the corona. And the plasma then is confined to these field lines. So if there's any buffeting, any dynamic motions which occur on the surface, it will be felt up in the corona.
Do you mean that it's kind of like the change in the surface propagating like just like a wave or something like more like a straight line or?
Well, the field lines will tend to occupy probably curved structures out into the upper solar atmosphere. But of course, if there's all of a sudden a dynamic or very impulsive motion towards the foot point of one of these magnetic field lines, it can cause deformations in the magnetic field line, which may result in a wave being generated and therefore propagating upwards. I mean, I think if you think of this as a slinky, which is extended quite a long distance and you knock one end of it, you can clearly see a wave propagating along the slinky as it moves to the opposite end. And that's exactly what we think is happening on the surface of the sun. We have these field lines extending up into the corona. We bump the field line perhaps at the bottom, which carries a wave form up to the upper ends, where it then may interact with some part of the upper solar atmosphere, releasing its energy in the form of heat.
When you say releasing its energy, it's like releasing the energy from the motion of the wave into energy.
Exactly. Because eventually, I mean, these waves will have to cease their movement, cease their propagation at some point. And by damping the wave, i.e. removing its energy in the form of a side-to-side motion, you can then convert that motion into heat, which will then locally heat the surrounding plasma in the corona.
How was that phenomenon would be related to the actual size or altitude of the corona? Is there like a special length at which this kind of wave would lose energy, or?
That's a very difficult and actually ongoing question that solar physicists are trying to answer. There are many different types of mechanisms which may promote the damping of wave motion and allow it to release energy in the form of heat. The problems that we currently don't know is, what is the dominant mechanism that allows the conversion of this wave energy into heat? And also, at what particular height does this most readily occur? And over what sort of spatial scales does it take for full conversion to occur?
Okay, that's very interesting. There's one last thing that I'd like to talk about. So as I was saying at the beginning, it's the sun, it's close by. You know, how come we don't know more about it? How come we don't observe it more? And something you mentioned in your presentation was about the solar observatory. And, you know, right now we have mirrors of 1 meter diameter, which to me, I'm an extragalactic astronomer. It's teeny tiny. It's small. And just like this is really big for the sun. And it didn't occur to me that you could have problems with bigger telescope than that. Do you want to expand on this?
Sure. I mean, one of the things is, for nighttime astronomers, you're looking at quite faint sources. And of course, they would not be faint if you were up as close to them as we are to the sun, but because they're so many, many light years away, they do appear very faint. And therefore you can use the large telescopes to collect all of the light that's given to you by those objects and be able to sort of do your analysis on that. The problem that we have with the sun is because it's so close by, it provides us with a lot of photons, a lot of light energy. And the problem is as we make our telescopes bigger and bigger, we collect more and more of this energy. And it causes immense problems with trying to cool these telescopes. At the minute, as you said, some of our telescopes are really around the 1 meter mark. We have pushed in recent years up to around maybe 1.6, but they're still a long way short of sort of everyday use nighttime telescopes.
Would it make like the electronics melt or something?
Well, yeah, I mean, the whole thing is, I mean, you're collecting so much energy that your optics and the building that you will be containing all of your optics and your elements and your mirrors will be placed under a huge bombardment of this energy, and very, very little would survive, I think.
So I guess it's a bit like having like a magnifying glass in the sun and trying to light a fire.
Exactly.
You mean like a gigantic magnifying glass?
Exactly. So, I mean, I think a lot of ongoing work for these large aperture solar telescopes is really trying to focus on, can we create a mechanism which will alleviate this excess energy, allow us to be able to collect enough light so that we can do our science, achieve our science goals, but at the same time not adversely affect the inner workings of the telescope.
Cool. There was also something about time frame on which you want to take your data, because I guess changes that we see in stars outside of the solar system and extragalactic, it's in like, you know, maybe seconds, milliseconds for some pulsars. But for the sun, you need, like, there's a lot of changes in very small time. Can the electronics we have right now handle this, or?
Yes. At the minute, many areas of research in solar physics are concerned with very small-scale dynamic motions within the sun's atmosphere. And these can evolve on time scales much less than 1 second. So it is paramount for us to be able to observe these on sub-second time scales. Current instrumentation can do the job very well on these smaller telescopes, and telescopes up to around 1.6 meters in size. The real problem will come along when we start to move up towards these massive 4 meter sized solar telescopes, because if we want to maximize our spatial resolution, we're therefore going to also need much larger imaging detectors to be able to maintain a similar field of view size, but obtaining this much higher spatial resolution, which then means we're going to be having many more pixels. The equivalent at the minute is we've only have really 1 to 2 megapixel CCD cameras that we're using, but in the future we're going to be trying to bump this up to around 16 megapixel cameras. And that may not sound like a difficult problem, but when you're trying to push the boundaries and trying to take frame rates on the order of 100 frames per second at 16 megapixels, that's when you really start to run into problems, and particularly with the acquisition, the handling, and the processing of such large data volumes.
Like, we did make huge files of data that you have to, like, put into computers very, very fast. The computing part is kind of, like, sluggish compared to what you need.
I think one of the main problems is you think a typical 16 megapixel image would be on the order of 30, 32 megabytes in size. If you're trying to accumulate 100 of those every second, data rates are going to be pushing gigabytes per second, which not only being able to transfer that from the camera to a hard drive to save is a problem, but also then what do you do once you've acquired images for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours? And that's only assuming one camera. If you have multiple cameras, you're going to end up with volumes that are so vast that it at the minute it seems impossible to deal with that situation. So a lot of ongoing work is to try and process the data on the fly. So that's real-time processing to allow you to process the data, do all your scientific normalizations and calibrations of that data while it is being saved to disk. So therefore you don't have to do that later. And it also will mean then that the volume of data that the user has to take home will be much reduced.
Yeah, because I guess if you don't do that, you'll end up with the building of the telescope, the building of the astronomers, and the building of the hard drive in which you store the data.
Yes, and as time goes on, that building for hard drives will get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Well, that was really interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Bye.
Bye.